Name. Not at night. Not in the wet sand. Grace wants to think of Jean, but her thoughts are muddy because she can't picture where he is or what he is doing. Does he have a shovel in his hands? Is he cowering in a river as she is in the ocean? Or is he sitting in someone's kitchen having a cup of coffee and a donut in order to keep his energy up? It would have been impossible, Grace understands now, for him to get a message to her, never mind come home to save her. How is it that they all read the fires so wrong, that no one understood that the town, and possibly the people in it, would be dust by morning? Nothing but hot embers, a whistling wind. The shaking in Grace's body is so intense that she feels as if her limbs will break apart. Her hands barely work when she reaches beyond her children to make sure nothing is sticking outside the blanket. Not a tendril of hair, not a foot. She will not allow herself to picture the advance of the fire to the water. They will not burn. They will not drown. "Rosie!" she yells. No voice answers her. She doesn't dare open her blanket. The heat has not abated. She waits another minute. "Rosie?" Hour after hour, Grace holds her children. She tries to keep them warm with her body. Her limbs stiffen and ache. A sensation of natural light. A cessation of sound. Only the wash of the water. The odd comment from afar. She tries to bring Tom and Claire closer to her, but her muscles are so cramped and numb she can't move. "Over here!" a man yells. Two men Grace has never seen before kneel on the sand and peer into Grace's eyes. "Are you hurt, ma'am?" one asks.
"Take the children," she manages. "Please, warm them up."
"Will do."
And the two men lift the blanket off Grace.
"Jesus," the other man says.
She knows the skirt of her nightgown is raised, but she can't care about that now. One man takes Claire, the other Tom. Awakened from their nightmare, only Claire begins to wail, a reassuring sound.
"Don't you worry, ma'am. We'll be right back for you."
Grace follows her children with her eyes. The only signs that what she sees was once a town are the perfectly intact brick chimneys, tall druids with awful stories to tell. In one chimney, two fireplaces are visible, one over the other, the brick of the second-story hearth still protruding. She spots a large vehicle the size of a bread truck parked across the street. The children are handed over to someone inside. Grace can still hear Claire crying. One of the two men comes back for her.
"The other man's wife is in there with your children. Can you move?"
The pain in her back and shoulders is searing, nearly unbearable. She shakes her head.
"Have you been here all night?"
"Yes."
She can see only his boots and then his knees.
"I'm going to try to roll you over," he says.
She can feel his hands under her shoulder and hip. She does all she can to help him, rolling with a thud, as if she were a frozen block of ice. She sees him lower her nightgown, but she has no sensation in her legs.
"You're pregnant," he says,
alarm evident in his voice.
"We've got to get you to a hospital."
"Why? Hospital?"
"You're suffering from hypothermia. Think you could give me your hands?"
Grace grabs both his outstretched hands and tries to stand as he pulls. He manages to get her upright, but as soon as he lets go, she falls onto the sand, her frozen legs not working as they should. He urges her upright again and tells her to put her hands on his head for support. He whips off his blue cloth jacket and rubs her legs with the flannel lining. He is rough with her to get the circulation going again. He stands, puts the jacket on Grace, and tells her to hook her arm into his.
"Let's give it another go," he says.
She is taken into the truck with many hands helping her. They coax her to lie on her side on blankets. She can hear Claire, from somewhere above her, crooning,
"Ma, ma, 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 ma."
"Hi, sweetie. You're a good girl. We're all right now." The truck lurches forward. Grace thinks, "I did it. I saved my children." Cinders. But no, she didn't. The bleeding begins in the truck. Exhausted, Grace drifts in and out of consciousness until she is woken by a pain low in her abdomen. She opens the blanket to see blood on her nightgown and the thin blanket.
"No,"
she cries. She has had these pains before. She knows what they are. She holds her legs tight together and pushes the blanket between them. "Hold on," the woman says.
"No, no, 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 no,"
Grace cries. She shuts her eyes and prays. She knows by heart only one prayer. She thinks the words as best she can until she is squeezed from within. At each contraction, Grace grabs for the woman's hand. She holds her breath.
"Baby, baby, baby, stay inside me, stay inside."
Between contractions, she nods off. She can't help herself, even though she knows she must stay awake to keep the child. The driver races ahead. When the truck stops, the back door is opened by a man in a white coat.
"How many months?" he asks.
5.
"Contractions?"
"Yes."
"Intervals?"
"I don't know."
Something in Grace's face must alarm the doctor, because he yells for a cot. While they wait, the doctor takes her pulse. He frowns.
"What?"
Grace asks.
"Racing," he pronounces.
Two men help her out of the truck and onto a gurney. They wheel her to the double doors of a brick building. The driver of the truck bends over her to say,
"Your children will be well taken care of. We'll be back to see you."
Inside the hospital, Grace is dizzy with swimming overhead lights. She hears deep coughing, yelps of pain, bouts of screaming. Patients lie on cots in the hallway, while others, grimacing, stand against the white tiles. She hopes someone has covered her bloody nightgown. A contraction takes her by surprise with its intensity, and she pushes against the rails of the bed.
"Don't push," the nurse behind her says.
But Grace can't control her body. Once inside a room, she is led off the cot to the bathroom, where her nightgown is removed. She is washed, given a new nightgown, and ordered to empty her bowels. Her body shudders with pain. She is helped back onto the gurney, and a nurse takes her information.
"Grace Holland. Eugene Holland. Hunts Beach. I don't know, it doesn't exist anymore. My mother, Marjorie Tate. Her house might not exist either.
2. A girl 2 and a boy 9 months." The nurse looks up at her.
"You'll give birth to this baby today,"
a doctor, not the same one as before, announces.
"It's not time," Grace insists.
A mask is clamped over her nose and mouth. Twilight sleep. Scopolamine. She has been here before. Grace comes to with grinding pain she remembers from less than a year ago. She wants to sit up, to push.
"You can now," the doctor says.
She braces her legs and arms, and with a nurse lifting her torso from behind, pushes blindly, going with the pain, pushing, pushing, pushing. For the second time, a mask is clamped over her nose and mouth. She dreams the ocean has overtaken her. She dreams she is fumbling beneath the skirts of her nightgown, searching for her children. She wakes to an image of fresh blood on a blanket.
"No,"
she cries silently. A doctor stands at the door. Grace wills him not to enter the room. To enter the room is to deliver information she doesn't want, information she already knows.
"I'm sorry," says the doctor as he stands at her bedside. "The child was born dead."
Her eyes fill, even though it's not yet sadness that overcomes her. She's stunned.
It was a boy, the doctor says. He never drew breath.
She closes her eyes and nods.
The woman caring for your son and daughter stopped by to give you her address and to tell you that both are fine.
The doctor doesn't offer Grace a chance to see the thing that she expelled, which only confirms her understanding of the event.
You need to rest away from the mothers for at least a week. You nearly died that night on the beach.
She wants to say, "No, I didn't." Instead, she asks about her husband.
I haven't seen a patient by that name. I'll check our records.
Alone, Grace turns her back to the door, rolls herself into a fetal position, and cries for her dead baby, a son. He would have been such a little thing, and she would have loved him to death. To death. She tries to speak to him, to tell him how sorry she is, but she can't find a way to envision a being to talk to. And what will Jean say when he hears? Will he blame Grace? Castigate her? She would prefer that to what she guesses will be his reaction. Silence. Perhaps a word. Maybe two words. She imagines that Jean made his way back to Hunt's Beach, to the cinders that cover the village acreage. Were any houses saved? Is there no one to tell Jean where his wife is? Will he have somehow found his children? An icy thought slices through her. It's not that he might be dead. No, it's that he might have walked away from his family. He might have seen the fire as an excellent portal to another life. A life in which he would never have to talk to his wife. In which he would never again have to go home. Grace's shoulders, back, and arms hurt. Her pelvis is heavy and sore. Her legs have needles in them. Having rolled into a fetal position, she thinks she might have to stay that way for days. Curving into herself is bearable. Sitting up is not. When did she give birth? This morning? Last night? When was she lying on the beach, her legs in the ocean? Has she lost a day? Maybe, as she burrowed into the sand, the fetus wanted to go back to the sea, to squiggle through her legs and swim away, knowing it could never be born. She will not have another baby. She will not make love again. Her womb will never heal from the injury she has done it. When Grace thinks about her children, she feels calm. A kind woman said she would take care of them. Grace must send someone to the address that awaits her at the front desk to make sure the children are all right. Perhaps the woman will bring Claire and Tom to the window so that Grace can look down at them and wave. How easy it is in this white cubicle, the lights dimmed. Has the fire burned itself out yet? She sleeps a deep sleep with no dreams. Grace is wakened by a nurse who wants to check the bleeding, take her temperature, listen to her heart. The nurse is abrupt in her commands, a little rough with Grace's body. Does she blame Grace for her current situation, or is this a mannerism left over from the war? The nurse makes Dr. Franklin, by comparison, seem like a lamb. A lamb. A lamb on the cover of a children's book. Gone. The entire contents of Grace's house. Gone. Even the papers and the children's clothes. Transformed into ashes. Will an insurance company honor a policy if the insured has no way to prove he or she was insured? She can't remember the name of the company or the man who sold the policy to them. Jean will know. But then again, where's Jean? Another, younger nurse appears with a tray of food. A ham sandwich and a bowl of rice pudding suggests lunch.
How long have I been here? Grace asks the younger nurse. I don't know, Mrs. Holland, but I can check. I just came on shift. That's fine. What's your name?
Julie.
Julie has short blonde hair under a smart cap, a white apron over a light blue dress.
You're a volunteer?
Yes.
How old are you? Grace asks.
She slips a spoonful of the rice pudding into her mouth. She might just manage to get this down. She can't even look at the sandwich.
17.
You've graduated from high school?
I'm about to be a senior.
Julie hovers respectfully at a distance, her hands clasped in front of her.
This is a good thing that you're doing, Grace says.
I had to help, didn't I? It's chaos out there because of the fires.
Do you have access to hospital records? Grace asks.
I can ask someone who does.
I don't know where my husband is, or my mother, or my closest friend. I was rescued off the beach with my two children.
I know.
You do?
Everyone knows.
Grace is surprised.
I need information about Eugene Holland, Marjorie Tate, Rosie McFarland, or her husband Tim. Don't you need to write this down?
No, ma'am.
I'd be grateful for any news. Also, there's an address at the front desk for me. It's where my children are. Could you bring me that address?
Yes. I'm sorry about your baby.
Grace nods. An awkward silence follows.
You can go now, if you like. I don't want you to forget those names.
I'm to stay here to make sure you finish your lunch.
Grace examines the tray.
If I eat half the sandwich, will that be all right?
The girl smiles. The sandwich half eaten and taken away, the rough nurse reappears to bind Grace's breasts, a procedure Grace didn't think would be necessary since the infant died too soon. But she is reminded of how full her breasts are when the nurse wraps her with a nearly sadistic efficiency.
I can't breathe, Grace says.
You can breathe, snaps the nurse, as if Grace had been whining. In her tight white shroud, Grace is drawn down into a pool of grief. Her body mourns as well as her mind. For the lost baby, for her missing husband, for her unmarriage. How can she possibly bring up Claire and Tom without a father? Would Jean have burned to death with unbearable pain, or would he have succumbed to smoke? Is it possible that he somehow survived? For hours, Grace is left to contemplate a man on a cross on the wall opposite, a particularly lurid depiction of suffering. Why would a member of a medical staff put a woman in a room with such a grim reminder of death? The placement of the object is dictatorial, suggesting that the patient ought to pray to ease her sorrow, or to realize worse things have happened to countless others, or to contemplate the story that came after the cross, the one about an afterlife, a door that closed to Grace when reason overtook her childlike fantasies. Is she meant to repent, for lasciviousness in the spring, for the challenge to her husband? She wonders if she ought to ask to have the gruesome object removed. On Grace's third day of rest, the rough nurse barges into her room with the news that the bed is needed in the emergency room for a husband and wife with serious burns. Two people with burns in a single bed? Grace stands at once, but her womb threatens to fall out of her body. She bends to keep it with her, but it's a sensual illusion. You need to squeeze your honey pot tight from inside, says the nurse, appearing to demonstrate what might be a tightening of the vagina, but looks more like a woman desperate for a pee. Grace can only nod. But quick now, get your clothes on. You're going home.
I have no home, and I haven't any clothes.
No clothes? Really? The nurse asks, not at all concerned by the disclosure of no home to live in. Who has a house anymore? All right, change your pad. Get yourself cleaned up. You've had no fever, no infection. I'll be right back with clothes. The man with the pickup truck is waiting for her when she emerges into sunlight. The young volunteer has called him on her behalf. He steps around and takes her arm.
My wife and I send our deepest sympathies.
he says in the way of a man who has never learned any other words to express the inexpressible.
I'm a little afraid to put you in the truck again.
He trails off, acknowledging that it was there that the baby died.
I'm sorry, Grace says. I'm not sure I know your name.
Matthew, he says. My wife is Joan.
And I'm Grace.
Yes.
Where do you live? She asks.
Cape Porpoise.
When the fire got close, she says, we thought of escaping to Cape Porpoise.
Good thing you didn't. The fire did a lot of damage. We were saved only because my son devised a way to suction water from the sea to the house. It worked. The fire passed us over.
Grace studies Matthew. He doesn't look old enough to have a grown son.
Smart young man, she says.
Matthew smiles.
He's 11.
Grace laughs. Brilliant boy.
Well, you know what they're like. A genius one minute, a moron the next.
I don't yet, but I expect I will someday.
My wife says your children are super. She's been missing the little ones. She said to tell you straight away that you're welcome to stay as long as you like.
Matthew and Grace drive through the residue of hell. Everything blackened, the trees dark, jagged shapes, a gas station exploded, the road itself charred. Shells of automobiles sit at angles to the road, and Grace hopes that the passengers were able to flee ahead of the fire. They pass a lump of metal, an object that might once have been a black Ford, a vehicle to which Grace refuses to assign meaning. They turn down a winding road that runs through what was once forest. They pass a burned barn, a chimney to mark the spot where the farmhouse stood. Grace notes places where the fire crowned, leaping from treetop to treetop, singeing the upper branches, but leaving the trunks and the ground untouched. A lone house with wash on the line shocks Grace, not only for its presence amid so much devastation, but for the uselessness of a wet wash that will only trap the cinder dust from the mild breeze. By supper time, the wash will be gray. But to have a house, to have running water, to have sheets. Grace has on a nurse's uniform with a woolen cape to keep her warm, white nurse's shoes that pinch. She hasn't a dime to her name. She's aware of coves that lead to the ocean. Matthew turns at one and travels along a dirt road. He stops the car at the only house standing, a shingled cape, the land behind it then dropping off to dark blue tidal water that moves in to fill the cove twice a day. Before she is out of the truck, Claire runs to greet her. Since Grace can't pick her up, she kneels and hugs her daughter with so much force that Claire struggles to get away. But then the girl is back for more, tumbling onto her mother. Grace can hear Matthew chuckling. A screened door slams. When she glances up, she sees Joan, Matthew's wife, holding Tom. Matthew helps Grace stand, and with Claire clinging to her leg, she takes her son from the woman. She wants to smell her boy, to make sure he hasn't lost his baby scent. He burbles, a grin across his face. When he starts to kick his feet in happiness, Grace gives him to the woman who has cared for him.
I can never thank you enough, Grace says. They've been a joy to have.
With her prematurely gray hair and wide nose, her dress tight at the waist and at the bust, Joan is not beautiful, but her smile is so warm that she seems beautiful to Grace, and, she imagines, to Matthew, who beams at her.
I'm just fixing dinner, Joan says.
She doesn't mention the lost baby.
Good, Grace thinks.
Here I can pretend to have moved on until I actually do move on. Will I be able to move on? Inside the front door is a boy who says,
Hello, I'm Roger. I know you're Mrs. Holland.
Hello, Roger. I'm sorry you had to share your house with my children.
Oh, they're okay. Tom isn't up to much, but I'm teaching Claire math.
Grace laughs. That can't be very rewarding.
It's all right. She's a little slow.
Roger has on a red plaid shirt and dungarees. She can see soot marks on his knees. He has left his shoes by the door, where there are three other pairs. Grace sits in a chair and takes hers off.
I spend all day cleaning, Joan says. But I can't keep the ash out of the house. We do our best, but it's going to take a snowfall to settle the black on the ground.
Grace glances at the living room, where the finest lace of dark dust permeates.
Eventually, I'll get it all, Joan says, putting on an apron. I swing wet towels around all day.
In the entrance to the kitchen, Joan has set up a playpen and a crib. Tom raises his hands in the air, a signal for his mother to pick him up. Matthew moves a chair next to the crib so that Grace can touch her son through and over the bars.
Mom, look, says Claire.
Grace watches in amazement as her daughter folds and then sets a napkin beside each plate on the kitchen table. Her children look months older than they did 4 days ago. On the walls, pretty wallpaper, bright oilcloth on the table, well-ironed yellow-checked curtains at the windows. All around them is black. Black trees, black underbrush, black ruins of houses. The air they breathe is full of black. On the banks of the cove lie random burned branches and boards, the flotsam and jetsam of 100 destroyed houses. They sit to supper, Claire on a wooden booster seat.
The Methodist church at Hunts Beach didn't burn, Matthew informs Grace. It's being used as a shelter now. It's a center for information. I'm not suggesting you stay there, but I am saying you might want to have a look at their bulletin board. You might be able to find your friends.
He doesn't say husband. He doesn't say family.
I put your name and address up on it a couple of days ago, he adds.
We don't have a telephone or a post office, though, Joan points out. It could take a while for a message to get to us.
No one has tried to find me, Grace thinks. I'd like to go there tomorrow, she says. Can you take me?
I sure can, says Matthew.
I don't have any money, Grace adds. I can't pay you.
Good Lord, scolds Joan. Don't you even think of paying. We're just glad we have a roof over our heads we can share with others.
And food in the cupboards. Hope you don't mind green beans and peaches. I thought my wife a fool for putting up so many beans, but now I think she's pretty smart.
And lobster, Roger pipes up. My dad can pull more pots than any man.
Now, now, Matthew mumbles.
You're a lobsterman, says Grace.
That I am.
But you didn't go out today.
Matter of fact, I did. When I got home, I got a call from the hospital. They said you were going home, so I waited with my truck.
Grace, overwhelmed by kindness, can't speak. Grace and her children have the guest room with two cribs. Grace guesses that either Joan or Matthew has borrowed at least one. Joan has apparently been collecting clothes for Claire and Tom, and has for Grace an entire suit of clothing that looks to have been made before the war. A blue tweed skirt and matching jacket, a nylon blouse, a slip, and a new package of underwear. How did Joan get her hands on underwear? Grace decides to sleep in the nurse's uniform. In the morning, she'll put on the new clothes, overdressed for breakfast.
Don't you look smart?
Joan exclaims when Grace and her children enter the kitchen.
It fits you perfectly.
Thank you, says Grace.
My wedding suit,
Joan explains as she scrambles eggs with a fork. Grace glances at the fabric, touches the skirt with her hands.
You can't give me this, she says, embarrassed. It's a treasure to you. Truth is, I was busting out of it when I got married. Never had it on since. But now I've found a use for it. Can't be sentimental about clothes when others need them.
I'll pay you back someday.
Don't be thinking about that. Get some eggs into you. You've got a tough day ahead.
If she had had a baby, Grace thinks, she would now be lying in the maternity ward for the better part of 2 weeks while she healed. The baby would be brought to her 3 times a day for bottle feedings. When she gave birth to Tom, she was offered the option of going home, but leaving Tom in the hospital for 30 days, $1 a day.
Give you a rest and get the little one fattened up, the nurse had said.
But to give birth and go home empty-handed had upset Grace. What was the point?
I'm a fairly good seamstress, Grace announces. I just need a mill store with remnants. I can work up a dress in no time if you have a machine.
I'll see if Matt, when he gets home, can go into Biddeford with you on your way to or from the church.
I have to find a way to make money, Grace says.
Joan glances at the clock.
Matt will come home early to get you to the church. You must be worried about your husband.
I am, says Grace, as she places finger food in front of Tom.
Claire insists on using a grown-up fork, which, in her eager hands, acts as a catapult, sending bits of eggs onto the wall and floor. Grace cleans them off as best she can.
You know, I feel fine, but my life ahead seems overwhelming.
We're here to help, and I think when you get to the church, you'll find lots of people willing to help, too. All the organizations have mobilized. The Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the Grange, any church that didn't burn.
Grace stares through the kitchen window at the unremitting black.
So this is what it means to survive a disaster.
The bulletin board is surrounded by a handful of people. Grace, in her blue suit, makes her way to the wall and, when she can, shifts so that she can read the notices.
Henri, I am at Arnaud's. Come at once.
Lost. Dark Terrier. Answers to Scruff. Leave note here if found. Mother, we are at Bishop's parents' house in Kennebunk. Anne. Please leave any word of David Smith or David Smith Jr., father and son, last seen in the vicinity of Hunt's Beach. Any sheep found with red marking on right hind leg belongs to Piscassic Farm, Route 1, Sanford, Maine. Grace studies each message. To be doubly sure, she scans the board again. Nothing. Below the board is a table with scraps of paper and a pencil. She writes her own message. Looking for Eugene Holland, Marjorie Tate, and Rosie McFarland. Write to Grace Holland, in care of Matthew and Joan York of Cape Porpoise. She finds a small bare patch in a lower corner. There she pins her query.
Grace finds Matthew, who reports no luck, and together they leave the cacophony of the sanctuary for the door. Grace hears heavy footsteps behind her. She turns to see a haggard Reverend Phillips.
Grace, he says, out of breath. This came for you, directly to the church. I didn't want to put it up on the board.
Grace waits an eternity for Reverend Phillips to hand the envelope over. If he expects her to open it in front of him, he'll be disappointed. Grace folds the envelope and sticks it into a purse borrowed from Joan.
This is Matthew York. He and his wife are helping me and my children.
Bless you, son, says the minister. This is a catastrophe. More and more arrive every minute.
Matthew drives for nearly an hour and parks in front of the Pepperell Mill.
I don't know a lot about fabric and such, so I'll wait in the truck and read the paper.
Thanks, Grace says.
When she opens the mill door, she sees that the rooms are being used as temporary shelters. She scans faces but doesn't recognize anyone. She studies the bulletin board with no result. Through the large window of the mill, Grace can see Matthew reading a newspaper in the truck. She slips closer to the window for better light. She opens the letter.
Dear Grace, Rosie was never much good at letter writing, so I am writing you instead.
but she's sitting at my elbow telling me what to write, if you can imagine her there. First, I have to thank you for saving her life and the lives of our children. From what Rosie has told me, if it hadn't been for your instructions, she almost certainly would have been caught up in the fire. I cannot even think about that. Rosie doesn't know where you are, and she asks that you write to the address on this envelope. You might notice that it's a Nova Scotia address. We aren't there yet. We are still driving down east, but we are headed to the town where my parents live. There, we'll settle for a bit, see if I can find work. There is nothing for us in Hunt's Beach. The house is gone with no insurance. The auto mechanic shop burned. As soon as you get this, please write where you are staying. Rosie misses you so much. She feels as though she abandoned you, but she had no choice when the fire department came and made her get into the truck. They promised her they would go right back for you. I wish I could tell you something about Jean. As you know, five of us went to the edge of town to make a fire break so that we could stop the blaze from entering Hunt's Beach. Before we knew what was happening, the fire came roaring down the hill straight at us. Two of us fled. I and one other man fell flat onto the ground, pushing our faces into the dirt. We were sure we were going to die. But as luck would have it, the fire crowned and leapt over us. When we stood, Jean was no longer with us. One of the men swore he saw Jean walking toward the fire, which was not a completely insane thing to do. If you can bury yourself in the dirt, it can sometimes be but a short moment until the fire passes, and then you're safe because everything behind the fire has already burned. I cannot and do not want to say that Jean perished in the fire. He was the smartest of all of us. I pray that he escaped unharmed. Rosie says she will die of boredom in Nova Scotia, so you must be our first visitor when everything is settled. Your good friends, Rosie and Tim. Grace slides down the wall to a bench, holds the letter to her chest, and is doubly pained by the true destruction of Hunt's Beach. Everyone will move away. What is there to go back to? A barren land with no house upon it. She can't even begin to think about rebuilding. Not without Jean. Even with Jean. Where would they find wood that wasn't charred? How would they come up with the money? How could they, as a family, live alone on a cinderscape? After some exploring, Grace finds a side shop that sells remnants. Most pieces are too big or oddly shaped to work for day dresses, but she discovers, beneath a small mountain of fabric, a piece of navy blue cotton, enough to make a dress for her and something for Claire and Tom, too. Joan gave her a dollar bill as she left the house in the morning. The cost of the navy blue cotton comes to $1.04. "I have only a dollar," Grace says. The cashier hesitates. Is it worth ripping away a fragment of a fragment? "Just take it," she says. "What you have is fine." "Thank you," says Grace, holding her wrapped parcel. "Matthew, I wondered if you would do something for me," Grace asks when she climbs back into the truck.
"If I can."
"I'd like to go to Hunt's Beach to see if anyone I know is still there."
"The fire department has been pretty thorough about searching all standing houses, but it never hurts to try."
"My father was a lobsterman," Grace offers.
"Was he now?"
"He died when I was 14. Went overboard in January." No need to explain to Matthew what happened then.
"I'm sorry," Matthew says.
"It would have been quick," Grace says, relying on that not very comforting old saw. She has too many times pictured the minute her father was in the water, before his respiratory system shut down from the shock and the cold.
"Yes, it would have been."
"It took my mother years to get over it. She lives on what the League of Lobstermen can provide. Some years the money is adequate, sometimes not. I went to secretarial school to help out. But then I met Jean."
"I'm sure she was happy about that."
"Yes, she was." They drive through blocks of yellow and orange foliage, and then through passages of black, as if flitting in and out of a train tunnel. In the green, Grace searches for pumpkins or colorful mums, anything that is a sign of normalcy. When Matthew turns a corner, she can see from several blocks away that her entire neighborhood is gone. Her mind's eye can trace every wall of her house, every chair, every kitchen tool, her mother's favorite tea mug. What is she already forgetting?
This is unbearable, she says.
Can't wait for the first snow, Matthew says. I'm not sure I ever said that before.
I need to get out.
The setting sun gives the water a shade of blue Grace has always loved. She used to think the sea the one blessing of winter. Even though the world around her was bleak, the water seldom lost its color. Today, the contrast between the dead black and the rich blue is almost impossible to believe in. She removes her shoes and puts her feet into the sand. 2 or 3 inches down, her toes connect with wet. She moves toward the water. She sticks a foot into the sea and then snatches it back. She is not tempted to go in. She knows the water chill of November, but she has come on a mission, even as she knows how strange it is. She thanks the ocean, that vast, indifferent entity, for saving her and Claire and Tom. News. Alone in her room, Grace sits on her bed, propped up by pillows, and reads the several newspapers she discovered in Joan's kitchen. She learns that fires ravaged Hunts Beach and that 150 of 156 homes in another seaside community burned to the ground. Along with Hunts Beach, 5 other towns were completely destroyed. She discovers that 3,500 people who were trapped on a pier at Bar Harbor were saved by the Coast Guard. She had no idea the fire had reached so far down east. She reads of a couple who moved all their furniture to the barn, only to have the house saved while the barn burned. Men in planes tried unsuccessfully to make rain with dry ice. Fire victims ranged in age from 16 to 80, and some farmers would not leave their livestock. Fire damage was estimated at $50 million. Home builders planned to build 1,000 homes, and Halloween was banned in Maine. Newspapers are strewn all about her, the collection telling of the immensity of the fire and its terrible toll. From the articles, she doesn't have a precise map of the fire, but it seems to have hugged the coast of Maine from Bar Harbor to Kittery. The carnage of the fire amazes her yet again. So many homeless, injured, or dead. She shudders at the report of the 16-year-old girl who died in an evacuee motor crash. Grace imagines the panic, the speed, and the horror in the realization that in leaving the danger zone, the girl was put in harm's way. Grace puzzles over the list of the dead, and a Mr. Doe from Sanford or Biddeford. Might the body have been named Mr. Doe by a coroner, pending an investigation, while a reporter took the name literally? Could the body be that of Jean, who left the 4 other men and walked into the fire? An act she would consider suicidal, were it not for Tim's letter. She remembers her fear that he might simply walk away from his life. Other stories compel her to read them again, such as the one of the man who wouldn't leave without his horse, and as a consequence, died of asphyxiation. The reports of the cost of the fires make her feel helpless, all the more so because her loss is but a tiny part of the whole, and it might take years for investigators to reach her. But the report of the committee plan to build 1,000 homes cheers her. She writes the name of the organization down. Her eye drifts to a story of the couple who were forced to separate after 51 years of marriage because the wife could no longer care for the husband. She was to remain in Maine while the husband was about to board a plane for California, where their son lived. It isn't a story about the fire, but the human interest of the tale captures her imagination. In the picture that accompanies the piece, the woman, formidable-looking, stands a head taller than her husband, who wears rimless glasses and is rotund. Grace would like to know if the woman is relieved to part from her husband of half a century, or is instead heartbroken but stoic in the face of the camera. Grace will never know. She refolds the newspapers so that they resemble the neat stack she removed from the kitchen. Tomorrow, she and Matthew will likely go back to the church for another look at the bulletin board. Or ought she go straight to the police and inquire about the Mr. Doe? She has taxed Matthew's generosity more than she should have, and can't ask for more. But she has to move forward, to locate her husband, to secure a job, and to find a way to rebuild her home. Headlights play against the window and then stop. It seems the entire house holds its breath. Grace walks to the head of the stairs, and when the door opens, she sees a familiar dark green coat.
Mother!
Grace yelps, running down the stairs. It's not her mother's way to embrace in public, but Grace can feel the force of her relief. Claire leaps from Joan's lap with a cry of,
Grammy!
Behind her mother is Gladys, who has driven Grace's mother to the Yorks. Behind Gladys stands her mother's other friend, Evelyn.
On the night of the fire, Gladys and Evelyn came with the car, and we headed toward your end of the beach, her mother says in a rush. But the road was blocked, and the heat from the fire so intense we couldn't get through. They told us that your part of the beach had been evacuated. Oh, Grace, her mother adds quietly while looking at Grace's flat belly.
It seems that everyone stares at her daughter's flat belly.
Any word of Jean? Grace asks, as they move toward the kitchen and sit.
Not yet, but men are still fighting the fires inland,
offers Evelyn, who then glances down. The explanation, which is no explanation, silences the table. No one mentions Mr. Doe. No one mentions the police. Claire, hearing an inaudible cry in the air, slides out of her grandmother's lap and makes her way under the table to her mother. Grace picks up her girl and holds her in her arms.
Lovely cake. Yummy.
Through all of this, Matthew drinks a cup of coffee, answering the polite question that comes his way. Grace can't read him. Perhaps he's uncomfortable in this group of women. She remembers that he has to get up at 4. When the small talk dies down, Grace senses the question on the table next to the cake plate and its crumbs. By rights, Grace and her children should go with her mother, who is kin. But her mother has lost her house too, and is living with Gladys. Would Gladys take in Grace and the children? She can't ask that question now, not with Joan and Matthew in the room. But after a second round of coffees has been poured and sipped, Grace's mother addresses Joan.
I can never thank you enough for rescuing my daughter and her children. We heard of the rescue at the church before we saw the note with your address. And then to have given them food and shelter is above and beyond.
Our pleasure, says a blushing Joan.
But we'll take them now. My friend Gladys has an extra room at the top of her house where we can set up a bed and a crib and a playpen.
I'll be sorry to see them go.
I'll second that, Matthew says. But of course we all want to see the family settled.
We'll take them tonight, Grace's mother says, and there it is done.
Having said their goodbyes and thanked Matthew and Joan, Grace, her mother, the two other women, and the two children are about to pull out of the driveway when a police car, lights flashing, blocks their exit. The policeman bends down and says to Gladys, who is driving,
I'm looking for Grace Holland. Is she with you?
I'm Grace, she says from the back seat.
Would you step out of the car, please?
The policeman walks 10 feet away from the car, and Grace follows.
You left this note at the church?
He holds aloft the scrap of paper on which she wrote the address of where she was staying.
I did, yes.
Has any of these persons returned?
My mother, Marjorie, is in the car,
and my friend Rosie is on her way to Nova Scotia. I still haven't heard from my husband.
That would be Eugene Holland?
Yes. He tips his cap higher on his forehead, as a farmer might a felt hat.
We've searched the entire area the fires covered and all the hospitals, and we have no one who answers to that name. We are officially listing him as a missing person.
Are there many missing persons? Grace asks.
In the beginning, we had 27. Now we have 2, including your husband. Do you have a photo of him?
She did, but doesn't now.
Can you give me a description?
About 5'11", normal weight, sandy hair, dark blue eyes. He's 29. A scar on his chin. He was wearing brown pants and a brown jacket. He'd gone to help build a firebreak.
Yes, we know.
The cop removes a card.
When he comes back, you give us a call so we can take his name off the list. He's probably had a knock on the head, or someone has taken him in.
He pauses.
Or maybe the shock of the fire has temporarily addled him.
The policeman doesn't say what Grace knows he is thinking, that Jean is dead. Grace is thinking something else. He's done a runner.
The idea, says Gladys, is to ease off the clutch slowly and give it a little gas, then steadily increase the fuel until the car starts to move. You keep it in that gear, first gear, for probably 3 or 4 seconds, and when you get this sound, a higher revving of the motor, you ease into second by depressing the clutch and going straight down with the shift, and so on until third, the hyphen over and up, and fourth, down here. It's an H, if you can picture it. You'll get the hang of it.
Gladys, in her purple coat and matching hat, offered at breakfast to teach Grace how to drive. Perhaps she'd seen Grace's restlessness, her desire to get a job and support herself in Jean's absence. 4 women and 2 children in one house has at times been trying. Grace is quite sure that Gladys and Evelyn are lesbians, though she never had that thought before living with the 2 women. It's in the way they brush the backs of their hands together in the kitchen, the tension in the evening, when they have to part in the hallway. Often both Gladys and Evelyn have their hands on the round ball finial at the end of the stairway railing as they delay leaving each other. Grace's mother must know, too, though she's never said a word to Grace. Does she often feel like a third wheel?
So we're moving, continues Gladys. But now, suppose I want to make a right turn. I roll down my window, stick my arm out, bend it at the elbow, and have the hand pointing straight up, like this. That tells any driver behind me that I'm going to slow down for the right turn. So now we down clutch, from fourth to third, watch the shift, to second and possibly to first, though that's seldom necessary. You want to give it a try? The night of Thanksgiving, Claire tries to climb onto her mother's lap. Grace lifts her up and senses the fever in the child's limbs even before she touches her forehead.
Mother, come feel Claire.
Her mother, dish towel over her wrist, puts the back of her hand to the child's forehead. Grace notes her mother's widening eyes.
She's spiking a fever, Marjorie says. Let's get her to bed.
On the sofa for now, Grace insists. I want to be able to watch her. Gladys appears with a roll of ice chips wrapped in a dish towel.
Put this on her forehead.
Mother, do you have any aspirin?
Yes, I might. Upstairs in my handbag.
She's shivering.
Cover her with blankets so she can sweat it out.
Grace thinks the instructions wrong, that her daughter's temperature should be brought down, but her mother has had so much more experience than she with sick children that she does as her mother suggests. Evelyn agrees. Quilts are found to cover Claire. Grace sits beside her daughter holding ice chips to her forehead. What infection has Claire picked up and where? She tries to recall all the places she has recently been with her. To the police station to deliver a photograph of Jean her mother had in an album. To Shaw's for tins of pumpkin pie filling, and then to bring a pie to Matt and Joan. Claire begins to shake, and Grace instinctively tries to hold her still. She watches with a mother's horror as her daughter stiffens and goes limp with a froth of white on her lips.
Oh, my Lord, what was that?
She's had a seizure, Gladys says. This is serious.
With one swift movement, Grace scoops up Claire, praying that the child won't have another seizure en route.
We've got to get her to a doctor.
With the overhead light on and Claire in a fetal position in the front seat, Grace reads the address of Dr. Franklin's clinic and her mother's hastily scrawled instructions as to how to get there. She drives through familiar wasteland and makes the turn onto Route 1. After several minutes, she sees a car coming to an intersection, downshifts, and presses on the brakes. Grace's car slides into a slow skid. Helpless, Grace puts a hand on Claire, pushing her into the seat, and steers as best she can with her left hand, which is no help at all because the steering doesn't seem to be working. Black ice. Grace spins across the highway, the other vehicle missing her by inches and honking, either in recognition of Grace's harrowing near miss or in anger at the almost accident. She straightens the car and continues on, never letting the speedometer rise over 15. Because the dark is impenetrable, she has to stop and face the signposts with her headlights. After half an hour, she spots the road she's looking for and follows that for a mile. She reaches the end and parks close to a Quonset hut, with only one other car in the parking lot. She gathers Claire and runs with her to the front door. After several loud bangs, a tall man in a white coat opens it.
My daughter's had a seizure.
I'm Dr. Lightheart.
He takes Claire in his arms and feels her forehead. Without a word, he walks with her to a room beyond the receptionist's empty desk. Grace has to run to keep up with him. He lays Claire on a gurney, strips away the blankets, raises her pajama shirt, examines her, then listens to her heart. He checks her back, looks at her tongue, and sticks a thermometer in her mouth.
Try to hold this here, he says.
Where's Dr. Franklin? She asks.
He retired after the fire. I've taken over.
A clean sheet is put on the gurney. Claire's body is limp.
We need to get the temperature down fast, he says, removing the thermometer from Claire's mouth and glancing at it. Have you given her anything?
One aspirin.
We'll cover her with cold towels. Then, if necessary, we'll put her in an ice bath. She won't like any of it, so be prepared. You'd best get her clothes off.
For the first time, he glances up at Grace.
You,
he says, puzzled.
You,
she says, astonished. Grace holds a bared wrist under the water until the temperature is as low as it will go. She remembers her legs buried in the muck of low tide, the way the doctor and Matthew thought she might be dead. She raised her head then, but couldn't move her arms, and the men had to slip the children out from under her grip.
When we found you, Dr. Lightheart says, the high tide of the night before had taken most of the belongings of the families that had come to the water's edge, but here and there the items were sloshing back in with a new tide. We'd been collecting people who'd been told to evacuate. I remember that I was watching the gas gauge on the dashboard of the truck. It was below empty, according to the dial. We talked about how you would have to be our last rescue until we found a gas station that hadn't burned down. Later, after we had you in the truck, I was worried we wouldn't make it to the hospital.
But you did, and thank you.
Grace wonders if the belongings sloshing in the ocean on the new tide had returned to be reunited with their kin. Claire looks as though she has been wrapped in a shroud. Death. Grace's knees weaken.
She needs the ice bath now, the doctor insists. I'll get the ice. As soon as the towels feel warm, unwrap her.
What do you think she has? Grace asks, frantic.
Scarlet fever, most likely, though it could be meningitis or polio. She'll need an antibiotic.
Holio.
When the doctor returns to the room, he sets a blue rubber tub layered with ice under the tap, filling it half full.
This is going to wake her up. What's her name?
Claire.